I assume that is probably from the context class that met here last night. Because we have, last night was just the second year context class, not the graduate class, and they were meeting here. Once again, by the way, you are all invited to our Thursday night classes. You can still sign up for that if you like. Last week was the first of the Thursday night classes. Milk, you were there.
Yeah, it's excellent. Very, very good. This is the training and
the class on the Pesach Haggadah, the Haggadah of Pesach. And it is taught every week by another professor from the seminary. Last week was Rabbi Harris, who is a biblical scholar, and this week is Professor Eliezer Diamond, who is Professor Talmud. So next week will be, if I remember, Professor Ann Lerner, who is Professor of Hebrew Literature and Women's Studies. So it's every week is somebody else, and a very interesting series. I think it'll be enjoyable, and we've had an extraordinary turnout for it. We had, last week, I think, we had 75 people there.
Professor Lerner is the 23rd.
Oh, Camp Bell is next week, so then Professor Lerner is the 23rd. Yeah.
Who is it who's teaching the fifth one again?
The fifth one is me.
No.
I do what they call cleanup. Got to do it at the end. Okay. Very good. Okay, we're on Daf Dalad Amud Bet. We're at the very end of 4B. So that's 4B3 in the English. 4B3. Okay, now we're going back to the subject that we have seen more than one time of Dinei Mamonot B'Shloshah. A court that is dealing with monetary cases is made up of three people. All right, that's simply a quote from our Mishnah. Over onto the next page, 5A1. Now look at this. Ve'im hayam umchel rabin dan afilu yechidi. But if the person, the judge, was a widely recognized expert, then he can handle the case on his own. He can handle the case on his own. Now, I want you to just sit on this for a minute, because we have seen, you might have thought that because the Mishnah says that there are three, that there are three. So, after we learned that there were three, we then saw that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi said there were, remember that, five. And now, we see that there are one. So you obviously see that we are not dealing with an issue of Torah law here. In fact, what we are seeing is that a lot of the discussion that we have seen so far, which you might have interpreted as Torah laws, if this is the law from God to Moses on Mount Sinai, it's not that at all. In fact, we are seeing that in the court cases, there are a variety of different traditions. And in fact, what the rabbis are doing is not necessarily deriving them from the Torah, but giving some Torah basis for things that they know independently. These are traditions, okay? And that's something that we recognize from time to time, and we've seen it. And the best way, very frequently you ask me, well, are they trying to justify something that they're already doing, or are they learning something from the Torah? And frequently I'll say to you, I don't know. Or we have to use the evidence of the text. Here, what I'm saying is that I think I have evidence from the text, because I saw three in the Mishnah, then I saw five by the author of the Mishnah, and now I see one. Okay, so obviously there were a variety of different practices, and you'll see some caveats with those practices. Okay, so Amar Rav Nachman Kagon, so Rav Nachman says, Kagon Ana, like me. Like me. Kan ana dan dine mamono bichidi. I am one of those people who can make those judgments by myself. By myself. V'chein amar Rabbi Chiya, and so did Rabbi Chiya also say, dine mamonot bichidi. Sorry, kagon ana dan dine mamonot bichidi. Like me. So he said the same thing Rabbi Chiya did, that I am able to make judgments in monetary matters by myself. Okay? Now, of course, this is a little bit surprising, and it would be odd if the Gemara will not further define the specifics of these circumstances, because it seems to us like these people are just boasting, but it's unlikely to be the case. So let's see what it is. Ibayalaho is now the Amoraim. Nishalalahem. When you have an Ibayalaho, we've learned something. We've learned a concept here that it is permissible to be a single judge in monetary matters. And, well, first of all, even before we get there, take a look at the Rashi at the top of the page. Take a look at Rashi. This is the first Rashi on Hey Amud Aleph, so it's right at the very top of the Hebrew page. Dan afilu biyachid. An individual is able to render judgment by himself. Dichtiv. Excuse me. What I wanted to show you is that he has a Torah source for this. So, lest you think that he was just making it up, we have another Torah source. We've had several Torah sources. Okay? So here, Dichtiv, and this is from Leviticus 19:15, Betzedek Tishpot, you shall judge righteously. And there, Tishpot is in the singular. It's a singular, it's not a plural. Okay? Now, of course, you could say to me, what kind of a proof is that? Maybe it means that when you have a court of three, this is addressing each one of the three judges by saying, you, when you're part of the court of three, you have to judge righteously. Okay? Well, maybe that's true. But anyway, it doesn't matter if it's true. This is what, at least according to Rashi, is a biblical source for this notion that there can be a single judge. And he says a little bit further on, I'm still reading in the Rashi, V'kasa var ein kan eruv parashiyot. And the person who takes this point of view has the point of view she'ein kan eruv parashiyot. Remember the notion of eruv parashiyot, the mixture of parashiyot? That was, originally we learned the notion of three from the case of the custodian. This was the unpaid custodian, and it was there that we saw ha'elohim three times. Okay? Maybe it was five times, depending upon you how to read the text during that the last two sessions. Okay? So that meant, you could say, you're reading that about the custodian, that applies to a custodian. Period. Okay? It doesn't necessarily apply to other areas of monetary law. But we learned that some of the rabbis, maybe most of the rabbis, have the point of view, sheyesh eruv parashiyot. Even though things are not stated next to each other, one thing is stated in the book of Leviticus, the other thing is stated in the book of Exodus, we can mix them together. Yesh eruv parashiyot. Okay? So here, this position is, ein eruv parashiyot. This person takes the point of view that there is no mixture. Namely, what we learned about the custodian, which is a court of three, doesn't apply in terms of cases of loans. There, it's enough for it to be a court of one. Okay? So, that's another point of view. You'll say to me, how could there be two points of view? There are two points of view.
Yes. But what's the context of this
land? We don't know. Oh, well, we see another context in here. We know the country. Well, let me read it to you. Since you asked, I'll tell you. Or at least I'll tell you sort of what it says. I mean, it's not, of course, it's not clear. Here it says, Lo ta'asu avel b'mishpat. You shall not do any perversion in mishpat. Now, first of all, what does mishpat mean? Okay, just but it doesn't. Justice. We have this notion of abstract notion of justice. A mishpat can refer, might refer to monetary law. It might refer to monetary law. It would not definitely refer to ritual law. Only other place it could refer to is marital law. Good. Okay? But it also could refer to monetary law. Lo tisa penedal, you shall not favor the face of the poor, v'lo tehadar penegadol, nor shall you honor the face of the great. Betzedek tishpot, that's the line. In righteousness you shall judge your fellow. Then lo telech rachil b'yamecha, that has nothing to do with it at all. Do not deal, how does it say, do not deal basely with your countrymen? Interesting translation. Okay. So my answer is, I don't know. But it is possible that the use of mishpat there is limiting. Okay. What would I learn from this? That in fact he's not learning it from here. In fact, there were a variety of different traditions based on the reality of courts. You know, we like to think that since this is a religious system and it has its basis in a religious text, that everything is going to come out of that. Well, the reality is that some things exist independently of it, although they always seek reference back in it. Okay? And you'll see more of this as we go on. Okay, so Imai Elaho, the question was asked by the Amoraim. Kogon Ana de Gemirna. Now, the ones who just said, like me, that I am qualified, I'm an individual who's qualified to judge these cases on my own, why? What gave them the qualifications? And this is where it's going to be interesting. Ana de Gemirna, is it because I have learned, Gemirna is Lamadati, I have learned. Usevirna, and I have learned logic and how to apply the law. Okay, those are, it's interesting from the perspective of you lawyers. Gemirna is to sort of learn the law. Sevirna is to apply it. So those are, as you well know, two very, very different things. You can memorize the law as it is, but to learn how to reason out the application of the law is something else. So these are separate. So, and then look at the next one. It says, Unekitna reshuta. And I have received authority, authorization to act on the law. Now here the assumption is, the commentators are saying, from the Resh Galuta. Now that is because we are dealing now with a Babylonian reality, and you will see that the reality in Eretz Yisrael is a little bit different, but we're dealing with a Babylonian reality, and we know that because of the Oraminu. Okay, the Oraminu is the Babylonian Amoraim are speaking here, and they say, well, there are three necessary, feet, right, that this is standing on.
Legs,
there you go. One is learning, the other is reasoning, and the third is authority, that you have in fact been granted the authority. You can't just have the authority to yourself, okay? You must have been granted the authority, or at least that's a possibility here. And exactly, you passed the bar. And somebody has the authority to say that you passed that bar. There's some structure. And in Babylonia, it was the Resh Galuta. Resh Galuta is Rosh Hagola, the head of the diaspora. So he was the legal head of the Jewish community in Babylonia. So all authority will come from the community, and the Resh Galuta is the authority in the community. Now, aval lo nakit reshuta dine lo dina. But if a person has not received authority, then he has no right to render such judgments. Oh, Dilma, or perhaps, afal gav delanakit reshuta dine dina. Or perhaps, if he hasn't received the authority, he's still qualified to render such judgments. So the Gemara, the Uraminu, is putting down really an essential question here. Is it those three legs that are crucial, or are two enough? Okay? Was it just happened to be that these people had authority from the Resh Galuta, or is it absolutely necessary that you receive that authority from the Resh Galuta? Okay? Tashma. So now the Mara is going to come and tell us a story. The Mar Zutra Bereden of Nachman Dan Din of Vita'a. It's an interesting case. Mar Zutra, the son of Rav Nachman, tries a case, assumedly here a monetary case, because that's the context we're talking about. Vita'a. And he made a mistake. He made a mistake in his decision in the case. So, of course, the person who was penalized realized that he made a mistake, and he wanted to get his money back. Okay? So, and there are damages. There may have been damages as well. Ata lekame de Rav Yosef. He came before, Marzutra came before Rav Yosef to ask whether he was liable to compensate the wronged party for the loss caused by the erroneous verdict. Now you remember, we had said earlier on that judges are in fact free from liability, and that was an important part of being a judge. Exactly. So they are freed from liability. So here, he asks the question of Rav Yosef, who is a Babylonian Amara, whether he's free from liability or not. Okay? Whether he's free from liability. In Kibluch, so Rav Yosef says, if Kibluch Kiblu Otcha, if the litigants accepted you upon themselves unconditionally, Lo Teshalem, you don't have to pay damages. You don't have to pay. The Ilah, but if they did not accept you unconditionally, Zil Shalem, then you have to pay damages. But notice, Shmamina, you can see from this incident, Kilo Nakit Reshuta, that even if a judge has not obtained authorization to adjudicate, Dine Dina, his judgment is a judgment that has to be accepted. Right? What we say is that the judge doesn't have an additional freedom from liability, okay, unless he has gotten that agreement out of everybody else. You understand? So if he hasn't received authority, as this Marzutra has not received authority from the Resh Galuta, we see that indeed he has some level of liability here. He's not freed from liability. But that is presupposing. So we're saying, he has liability, he's got to pay. But still, his judgment's a judgment. Right? The Gemara is, in fact, accepting the fact that his judgment is a valid judgment.
Where does the inference come from that he didn't have authorization from the Resh Galuta because they're discussing getting permission from the individual?
Correct. Exactly. Because otherwise there'd be no question in the matter. Exactly.
How did they know someone made an error? Somebody didn't agree?
Well, no. It would, correct. Here it appears that the judge is admitting to the fact that he made the error. However it came about, it can happen that a judge realizes that he errs.
Itself, it's not through an oversight process or an...
Well, we don't know. The truth is we don't know. And we're just not given that information. But he is not contesting that fact. He's accepting that fact. And he simply has to clarify whether the he's not actually clarifying whether the judgment is a judgment. He knows the judgment is a judgment. He's simply clarifying whether he's liable in the case. Okay?
I'm not clear on what it means if they did not accept you unconditionally.
Mm-hmm. Unconditionally would mean almost if it's an arbitration case.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's arbitration. And they will accept whatever the judgment is. And if it's an absolute acceptance, then in fact, you're in the same position as somebody who has a higher level of authority, which is to say somebody who has the authority of the Resh Galuta. He has then secular authority. Okay?
So that is, they've accepted his judgment.
Correct.
As a valid judgment.
Exactly.
And what is the alternative of not accepting his judgment?
That the judge maintains a certain level of liability.
Referring to the judgment after the fact, or accepting them to be the judge?
Well, no, it's before the fact.
Right.
That before he's asking, well, before the fact,
right. Did they accept?
Did they accept? And the assumption is here that he should have said something to them. You know, I don't have Resh Galuta authority, so that's not there, but it's assumed here. And
it's non-binding arbitrator to have a right to appeal. In which case, this decision is binding but not permanent, so it can be...
Well, that we don't see. They don't discuss that.
Well,
I mean, you're taking a modern perspective on it. All I can say is what's here, so we don't have any information beyond that. Okay?
Did they get paid?
I do not know the answer to that. I don't know the answer.
If they don't know, we never knew how they get paid.
Correct. Okay, Amar Rav. So we go on. Rav says, Hai man debai lemidan dina. One who wishes to be a judge and to make judgments. Ve'ita'a mibai lemiftara. And if he wishes to absolve himself if he makes a mistake, lishkol reshuta mebeiresh galuta. So here we say it's very right. He articulates it. That person needs to receive authority from the head of the diaspora, from the Resh Galuta. So here, the Gemara just clarifies really what the issue is here. Rav makes it very clear. V'chein amar Shmuel, and that is in fact what Shmuel says, Lishkol reshuta mebei Resh Galuta. You have to receive the authority from the head of the Gola.
Rosh Galuta here takes the position of what the Sanhedrin used to take and give samchut or asmacha.
Well, not so much the Sanhedrin, but it would be the counterpart of the Nasi in Eretz Israel.
So, A, if Rosh Galuta must be called Levi, or it can be any other rich head of community, guy, mm-hmm. Or we must be somebody who is religious or rabbi or some kind of...
Well, the reality is somewhere in between the two. Because he's got to have a certain level of knowledge, but he doesn't have his position because of having the highest level of knowledge. A lot of it is political as well.
Okay, so can he make decision that this guy or that guy will judge on other issues or just name him or not? Can he give other authorities just to be
yes,
a judge?
Yes, he can give other authorities to be a judge. Correct. Because he has secular authority.
It says in the secular authority. He has to be from the Davidic dynasty.
Well, but that doesn't mean he knows anything.
No.
Correct.
I'm saying
correct.
But
because it could be somebody who is just a rich guy who can...
He needs the right genes.
The tradition was partly a tradition of Yichus. Partly a tradition of Yichus of the Resh Galuta, and that was often the case, that these positions of authority were combinations of Yichus and money and charisma. I mean, there were several different issues that were involved.
Would you say Mordechai was Resh Galuta?
As far as I know, he was not Rosh Galuta.
Who was Rosh Galuta at this
time? I have no idea. Because the Book of Esther doesn't say. Okay.
No, because he took a big risk to make decision of that. Oh.
far as we can, from the Purim story, it appears that this functioning community with a legal head to it was not functioning at that time. It was pre the development of this, because that was the very beginning of the Babylonian exile, okay, the Purim story. It's the Persian conquest after the Babylonians, and what we're seeing here is, first of all, about 1,000 years later. So we shouldn't expect that the reality of 1,000 years later will be exactly the same as it was before. Here, you're dealing, well, it's not exactly 1,000 years. Rav is from the 3rd century. So that's 500 is 750 years later. Okay? So that's quite a while later. Good? Okay. Let's keep going. Yes, sir.
So the notes here suggest that the expert is a person who has demonstrated abilities as a judge.
Correct.
So that means you could be a judge if you were not such an expert, but you couldn't do it well.
Yes, no, that's correct. But you remember the way it says the hayam mumchel rabim. That means that you have sort of widespread acclaim for your competence in a particular area. And people who have that, assuming that that means, to begin with, a great deal of knowledge, the ability to apply the knowledge effectively, and now we've seen the third leg of it, which is also authority from the Resh Galuta, those people, they're unusual people, but we see two people who said, Kagon Ana, like me. So there are such people.
But I'm saying that the reshut from the Resh Galuta
right.
here is to be an expert, try a case of wounds, let's say, mm-hmm. singly without liability.
Correct. Correct.
But that, according to these notes, that person could get into that position by having only by having already demonstrated his
correct.
Initial expertise.
Correct. That's correct.
So there must be another level of
course of three.
Yeah, exactly. This person would have been already functioning in the lower system, I'd say, with courts of three. But to be able to function as an individual authority, you really had to be a widely recognized authority. Okay, now the Gemara goes on. Pshita. Neha. Now, look at the discussion here. Again, you're reading a discussion of Babylonian Amoraim. So they say Pshita. Pshita is when the Gemara says, it's obvious. Pshita mihacha lahacha umehatam lahatam. It is obvious that when you get somebody who's granted authority in Babylonia, that they can function in Babylonia. And it's obvious that somebody who's granted authority in Eretz Yisrael can function in the land of Israel. Umehacha lahatam mahani. And it is also pshita. It's also obvious. That mehacha, if a person has received authority from the Resh Galuta, that they can function in the land of Israel. Or it's obvious. Sure it's obvious. Okay. And now they give you even a biblical source for it. Dehacha shevet vahatam mechokek. As it teaches in a Baraita. Hacha shevet, we are the shevet. There, they are the mechokek. So it says, "Kedetanya lo yasur shevet miYehuda." There shall not be the scepter shall not depart from Judah. And here, these are the Babylonian rabbis saying, "Ele roshe galuyot shebabavel." This is referring to the Resh Galutas. The leaders of the Jewish community in Babylonia. Now, imagine, just think to yourselves how bizarre that is, because it says, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. Yehuda means Judah. And Judah is not in Babylonia, but in the land of Israel. So they obviously saw their own authority as so great that they took a verse like that and they related it to themselves. A little bit unbelievable.
What's the reward?
I don't know. That's the nature of Jewish communities. Jews are very difficult. Elu roshe galuyot shebevavel shorodim et Yisrael b'shedim. They are the ones who lead Israel with a scepter. Okay? You see their sense of their own sense of authority there.
That's why it's a Babylonian Talmud.
Fair enough. Nice. You wouldn't see this in the Jerusalem Talmud. You never. U'michokek mibein raglav. Michokek is literally a legislator. And that's the other half of that verse. The first begins Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda U'mechokek Mi Bein Raglav, and the Mechokek, the legislator. Now get this too. I should whisper this to you. They shouldn't hear it on the internet. I think this is a dirty joke. Alright, who are the Israelis? They're between their legs. Okay, this is just a very negative statement about the Israelis.
First
from the
joke.
It's okay.
It's reality, I think.
But the reality is no, the art school didn't pick that up. No. Okay. Elu b'nei banav, the mechokek, let's take it in a positive way, the way Art Skull understands it, okay, a scholar, mibein raglav, from among his descendants, elu b'nei banav shel Hillel, those are the children of Hillel. Hillel lived in the land of Israel, okay, shemelamdim Torah b'rabim, who teach Torah in public. Okay, so that's referring a lower level of authority from the perspective of the Babylonian rabbis goes to the Jews of the land of Israel. Keep in mind one other dimension of this, which I think is implied here, which is part of the subtle cut. I mean, I think what I said about the imagery is probably accurate. Also, Hillel was from Babylonia. And what Hillel did was, Hillel went to the land of Israel. He was born in Babylonia, and he then went and taught in the land of Israel. So from the perspective of the Babylonian rabbis, what did he do? Did he make aliyah? It was not an aliyah. It was a yiridah. He went down to the land of Israel. Okay? Because they bring up, of all people, Hillel. In other words, that's the Jeb. Hillel was the one who left Babylonia and went to the land of Israel. Okay? So it's a very low comment about the land of Israel. So it's a little hard to believe they could say that. Okay? All right. Mehatam lahache mai. So now they ask, so they say it's perfectly obvious that anybody who receives the authority of the Resh Galuta in Babylonia can exert that authority in the land of Israel. Now, I'm not sure it's obvious, but that's what they say it's obvious. But then they say, Mehatam lahachimai. How about somebody who gets the authority of the leadership in the land of Israel? Does he have any authority when he gets to Babylonia? But that's what they're asking now. Okay. Tashma. Okay. Come and hear. Rabba Bar Chana Dan Dina V'Ta'a. Rabba Bar Chana, who was an Israeli, tried a case in Babylonia, and he made a mistake. What? This is the same formulation now that we saw before. So, if he had authority, then he would have no liability. Right? So, we're seeing a continuity of examples here. And what we want to know is whether he has liability in Babylonia. Because if the authority from Eretz Yisrael, where he got his authority, will still be effective, then he will have no liability. Okay? So that's how they're going to find out. He came before Rabbi Chiya in Eretz Yisrael to see whether he was liable for damages. Amalei, Rabbi Chiya says to Rabbi Bar Chana, Iki bluch alayu lo tishalim. If the litigants originally accepted you upon themselves, you do not have to pay damages. Ve'ila zil shalem. And if they haven't, you got to pay. V'ha Rabba Bar Chana Rishuta Havanakit. But Rabba Bar Chana had obtained his authority from the Nasi in the land of Israel. Okay? And so we see even that the rabbis of the land of Israel acknowledge the fact that when you get your authority from the rabbis, the head of the rabbis in the land of Israel, that in fact it's not good in Babylonia.
But this is the Babylonian Talmud. What is the Jerusalem Talmud? Does it have the same case, and does it come to the same conclusion?
It's not there.
This says
Hillel. I'm sure it's a big surprise to you.
The footnote says that Hillel was actually the Nasi in Israel.
Correct. At that time, he was considered to be the Nasi, at least from the Talmud's point of view. Whether you actually had a Nasi at that particular time is another question. But from the perspective of the Talmud, yes. And I think the real issue here is that he was the leader of the Jewish community, but he was a yored, as it were. He was somebody who had come down from Babylonia. Yes.
I have a technical question. So two guys come in front of the judge, and he asks them, are you going to accept my authority? And both of them say yes. So he's not liable. Mm-hmm. So why retroactive? If he didn't ask that, I mean, if I would say no, I will not accept your authority, there is no case here. Like, we need to go to a different judge.
Well, he's so simply trying to clarify it. He goes to the rabbi, to his his superior, and he's not sure of the law. He's not sure of all the details, the dimensions of this. So his superiors simply make it clear. If you've already established this with your clients, then it's okay, and you have no liability.
So if one side says, I'm not going to accept it, how the issue will be resolved?
But you're talking about what happened before. This has to have been established before they rendered any judgment. Okay. Before he rendered any judgment.
Correct. Right. Two guys come in front of the judge, and one say, I will not accept his authority. How will
then,
he be resolved?
Then he's not going to, then he won't be a judge.
So there is no judgment. So
correct.
The guy can always be in the neighborhood and say, I'm not, I don't care.
Well, that's not what we're talking about.
I understand. What,
but you're telling me a case which is a different case. A different case is a different case.
How the system will resolve the case?
To go to another judge in that case. Or, if you have an established system of courts, in fact, you have to go to the local court. Well, we've seen courts
forced.
Like that. But you're not forced to go to the court. No, you're not forced to go to the court. Okay? There was another comment there. Yes,
I was just going to make the analogy to our contemporary times with same-sex marriages, and some states will recognize other states. Only one state, a few states will recognize it for all other states who do authorize it, and some states won't. So it's an analogous situation.
Okay. So another, yes.
There is some similarity in the attitude of the Babylonian rabbi to an attitude of the Eastern European rabbis when the first recruiters came to round up young people to make Aliyah in the early part of the last century.
Absolutely right.
Because it was a backwater. Today
it's quite different. If you read the things that are going on today, the Israeli rabbis have no respect for the American rabbis. The RCA is going through this. The Rabbinical Council of America has its conversions are not accepted by the Israeli rabbinate. How could that possibly be, right? It's inconceivable. Well, it's inconceivable, but that's exactly what's happening. So it's bizarre the things that happen, but this is the nature of Jewish communities. They have a level of self-confidence, and part and parcel of that is a denial of the significance of another Jewish community. And we see it happening right now. But it's the reverse condition right now. Frankly, it was happening in the opposite direction earlier. 75 years ago, the American rabbis looked down on the Israeli rabbis. But it's exactly the opposite.
I'm not so sure that that's such a bad idea. Mainly because I think, maybe some of the lawyers will help me out, my understanding is that legal scholars came to a general conclusion that justice is better the closer it is to home.
Okay, you just tell the American rabbis that. Okay. You may be right. You may be right, but there are problems. There are problems. Okay, let's keep going.
Why should we be the only people who like Jews?
Okay, let's keep going. Down toward the bottom here. Palomahane. Is it not... You mean to say that somebody authorized by the Nasi in the land of Israel, that authorization is not effective in Babylonia? All right, so now we're going to see an opposite point of view. We just read that it's not effective in Babylonia. So then now the Gemara is saying, what do you mean it's not effective? Sure it's effective. Okay? Now we'll see a case. Rabba bar Rav Huna, ki hava min se bahade v'veresh kaluta. When Rabba bar Rav Huna argued with those in the house of the Resh Galuta, and he was somebody from the land of Israel, Amar lav minaychu nekitna reshuta. He said to them, I did not obtain authorization from you, nekitna reshuta me abamari. I obtained authorization from my father, my master. The Abba Mari me rav verav me rabichia verabichia me rabbi. And my father, my master, obtained his authorization from Rav, and Rav from Rabbi Chia, and Rabbi Chia from Rebbe. Rebbe, the author of the Mishnah. Okay? Right? So here, someone in Babylonia seems to at least think that he's authorized by the Nasi in the land of Israel. He's arguing a case in front of the Resh Galuta. Okay? So then the Gemara says, "Bemilta de Alma hu de Okimla." Rabba bar Rav Huna stopped them with mere words. Right? But in reality, he was subordinate to the Resh Galuta. So that's how the Babylonian Talmud says he thought he had authority, but the reality was he didn't. Okay? So he was acting as if he did, but he didn't have it. Right? But now that authorization from the Nasi in the land of Israel, Lamahani, is not effective, Rabba bar Chana reshuta de nakat lamali. Why did Rabba bar Chana obtain authorization from the Nasi? This guy was going to Babylonia. Why did he try to get the authorization from the Nasi in the land of Israel? Because it's not effective. Right? So this, we have the same thing in the modern world today. Why would you get a smicha from an American yeshiva and try to function in Israel? They won't accept it. Okay? So obviously you should have gone to an Israeli yeshiva. So why, you know, you could have done it. Why? It's stupid that you went to an American yeshiva. Okay? That's the same case here. So why did he do it? Why did he get the authorization in the land of Israel? La'ayarot ha'omdim al hagvulim. Because there were cities on the border between Babylonia and the land of Israel, and those cities functioned with Israeli law. So in other words, it was useful to have in his pocket another smicha, because it was useful for people who lived on the border. And he wanted to be able to have, I guess, as much authority as possible. So there was an area right on the border where he was effective, where he could be effective. Okay? Now, the Gemara goes on. My Reshuta. what was the authorization received by Rabbi Bar Chana? Ki hava nachit Rabbi Bar Chana leBavel. When Rabbi Bar Chana was going down to Babel, now here, thankfully, they use the language of nachit, that when you leave the land of Israel, you're going down. I might have expected them to actually turn that language around, but they didn't. So good for them. Okay. Amar le Rabbi Chia le Rabbi. Rabbi Chia said to Rabbi, and here you're seeing now the actual process of the authorization. And the process is a very interesting process. Look at the way it's done. Ben Achi Yored le Babel. My brother's son is going down to Babylonia. And here he says the following. Yore? It's a question mark after that. Can he render decisions in ritual law? In ritual law. Yore? Rebbe answers, Yore. He may render such decisions. Yadin? Can he render decisions in monetary law? Yadi. He may render such decisions. Yatir bechorot. May he permit blemished firstborn animals? Yatir. Okay, Rebbe answers, he may permit them. Now, let's explain what this last thing is. This, by the way, is the traditional form of the traditional smicha, rabbinic ordination. Rabbinic ordination was always spoken of in this way. Yore, yore, yadin, yatin, yatir bechorot. Okay? Yore, yore, yadin, yadin, yatir bechorot. That's the traditional smicha. Which, interestingly, the Jewish Theological Seminary did not give us that smicha. We don't have a smicha law. Because they didn't want to encroach on this traditional formula, and in fact, it wasn't certain that we were qualified in those areas. Because they felt that the American rabbinate didn't really need necessarily exactly that type of an okay from the authority, and rather they tried to conceive of authority coming from an institution. And that was, even into my time in the seminary, I don't know what it is today, I suspect it's just another world today, but in my time, the question that we had was whether you wanted to get your ordination from the seminary or from the dean of the faculty. And the reason why that was an issue is that traditionally rabbinic smicha comes from a person and not from an institution. And the seminary tried in its effort really to professionalize the rabbinate in America, because people would come from Europe. Your example of Europe, people would come from Europe. You're talking about the good rabbis in Europe. A lot of freeloaders would come from Europe. They had no way to make a living. They got to America, and they put out a shingle and they said, we're rabbis. Because there were rabbinic jobs. I was doing research years ago on Rabbi Lepukhet in the synagogue. I was writing history. And it turned out that the rabbi, this is the rabbi before Milton Steinberg. So he served there in the late 20s. He had been, came to America, and was hired as a rabbi. And that rabbi, that congregation had had some other predecessors here in the neighborhood. There was the synagogue right where we are, 127 East 86th Street. Not 82nd, but 127 East 86th Street, where the Citibank is today.
No,
the Citibank is. That was a synagogue. Next to Wayne Reed, correct. That was a synagogue. That was a synagogue. It used to be a synagogue, that building. And there was another synagogue that was on 72nd Street and Lexington Avenue. those two synagogues combined. They combined with each other. And they then bought the land at 50 East 87th Street and built there, I think it was 1927, if I remember, something like that. I think it was 1927. So, to go back to the 20s, well, it would have been 27, and this would have been the rabbi then who was in the city bank, as it were, in that particular spot. One of the congregants was on business in Europe, and they checked out the rabbi. And it turned out that the rabbi had no smicha. He had come to America and had just said that he did. So they fired him. And that's what was the opening of the position that led to Milton Steinberg eventually becoming the rabbi of Park Avenue Synagogue. It's a major change in American Jewish life. But it was all from this fake rabbi, Because that's the way people used to do it. They knew a certain amount of things. They knew more than the congregants did, and so they advertised themselves for it, but they had no authority.
Did you go over the words that they used in the ordination?
Yore, yore, yadin, yadin, yatir, matir bechorot. Yore, yore, these are technical terms. So to say what it means, I have to elaborate on it. Yore refers to ritual law, that a person is able lehorot, to be a moreh, a teacher in ritual law. In other words, you can render decisions if there's a chicken is kosher, it's not kosher. Or in the laws of the Sabbath, for example. Okay, that's yore yore. Yadin yadin it's shorthand for dine mamonot, which is monetary law. So that you have competence in that area. Matir Bechorot is the third category. Now, Matir Bechorot refers to the Torah's law of the Bechor, an animal, any of the animals that was brought to the temple, which is to say a sheep, a goat, or cattle. Okay? They could be offered on the altar. The Torah says that the firstborn, the Bechor, of the animal has to be given to the Kohen. Becomes the property of the Kohen. Okay? Now, while the temple was still functioning, that was useful because it was really a form of taxation which worked and it went to the Kohen. But once the temple was destroyed, the whole thing really didn't function that way. The whole process really went into remission, as it were, and it didn't function anymore. But the law of the Torah is the law of the Torah. So it became customary to, because you can't use something that is the property of the temple cannot be used. And because the Torah says that a Bechor becomes the property of the temple, it simply can't be used. So if a farmer has a flock, the flock produces a Bechor, that Bechor simply cannot be used. So the Bechor has to be left on its own. You can't use it for any purpose whatsoever. You surely can't shear it, that's if it's a sheep. You can't slaughter it. You can't do any of those things because it's temple property. Okay? As a result of the law of the Torah. However, the Torah also makes the provision that if the animal has a mum, a blemish, right, then it can no longer be brought for a sacrifice. So in fact, what the law became was that it became advantageous for the rabbinate to be able to know when a blemish was a blemish that wouldn't go away, when it was a qualified blemish. And there are such qualified blemishes, but you had to be an expert in blemishes to the Bechor. So Matir Bechorot means someone who is qualified to know the difference between a passing blemish and a significant blemish to the animal, Because if it is a passing, if it is a significant blemish, then the animal is free from the kahuna, right? Cannot be used on the altar. And then, in fact, the farmer can do what he likes with it. So, for economic reasons, it was helpful to have people who are experts in that area. That's why, in an agrarian society in Eastern Europe, the rabbis would generally also become experts in Matir Bechorot. Today, the American rabbis don't get that. Generally speaking, they get Yora, sometimes Yadin, sometimes, not all the time Yadin, because, frankly, for American rabbis, monetary issues are not particularly relevant, because we have this concept of Dina de Malchut Adina. The law of the state takes precedence over Jewish law. So unless you agree to an arbitration procedure to go to a Bet Din, okay, then a Bet Din will have some power. But generally speaking, monetary matters are subject to the law of the state outside of the land of Israel. In the land of Israel, it's different. In the land of Israel, it's different. Israel today has its own courts. It has a complete system of rabbinic courts in addition to the regular courts. And many people will prefer to go to the rabbinic courts rather than to go to the regular courts. So there are shadow systems of courts in the state of Israel. And people will become judges and experts in particular areas of the courts, and they work in those areas. So in the land of Israel, once Jews began to go, well, Jews in Eastern Europe had goats, and they had sheep, and they had cattle. So it was relevant there. It really wasn't very relevant in America. So it sort of has gone out of, I was just talking to somebody yesterday about the Jews who went to Vineland, New Jersey. Vineland, New Jersey was an agricultural community. It was a chicken community. But of course, chickens were not brought to the altar. Couldn't bring a chicken to the temple. So the Bechor didn't apply to chickens. Only applies to the mammals. Only applies to these three mammals. So the Matir Bechorot is still active in Israel, but it's rare that you see people getting that expertise in America
today. Who does the goat feed? And there's no temple. So... The animal simply
grazes. It says the understanding is the animal can't do anything. The animal simply grazes.
Can they use them for breeding?
Nope, can't do this for anything. It's not you can't do it. No, there's no pidyon ben, nothing. It's the temple property, and problem is there's no temple.
In more modern times.
Yeah.
So if you were talking about Eastern Europe, you had goats.
Yeah. Right. So what you said you needed?
His wife grazing, but you did not have to redeem him from the client.
No, you couldn't redeem him because there's no such procedure in the Torah.
Well, you do it with humans.
Because there's a procedure in the Torah. The Torah says.
Oh, I see.
If the Torah tells you that, then you have a procedure. But you can't invent that procedure.
Yes. Okay. So if you wanted to get qualified for all three of those things, how would you do it? Couldn't do it at the seminary.
Correct. Couldn't do it there.
Could you do it anywhere in America?
Why, you probably have some way to do it, I bet.
They do the
Yad and
Yad, I know
they do Yad.
Rabbis being referred to as having Yad and
Yad. Yeah, so Yad and Yad, I know. Matir Bechorot, I'm sure there's somebody at YU who could do Matir Bechorot. Because it's a special thing. It's not for everybody, but it'll be a special thing. And there could conceivably be some use in America for it. Maybe if they're Jewish farmers. If they were Jewish farmers, it would be an issue. It's true. But I'm not sure how many Jewish farmers there are. There are plenty of Jewish slaughterers, but I'm not sure how many farmers there are. Yeah, it's probably a growing field. You're right.
Silly question. Why do they repeat Yad and Yad?
Oh, that's a good question. Because the first one is a question mark, and it's from here. Yeah, because this, exactly, this is Rabbi Chia asks Rebbe, Rabbi Judah the Prince. He says, Yore?
Yeah.
Yore. Yadin? Yadin. Matir Bechorot? Okay. So
but
it's a question.
They only say one for the last?
Correct. They only say one for the last one. Yeah.
It's too long to say.
Well, here, I mean, we our formulation is we only say one. But here, it's the whole thing. Because it says, Yatir b'charot, Yatir b'charot. Okay.
Weren't there doves that were sacrificed at some point?
There were doves, but they were not subject to the laws of Bechor. Okay? Doves are not subject to the laws of Bechor. The laws of Bechor are only mammals. Only mammals. Okay? I don't believe so. I don't believe so.
Because we read his...
Yeah, you saw his ordination, but he has actually two ordinations. He has an ordination from Rabbi Zalman Nehemiah, who is, that's a sort of a Haredi ordination, and then he has the ordination from the yeshiva. So, but I don't think either of them is... because then what happens today in many of the yeshivas, you get a yora, not even a general yora, but you get, it's listed the specific pages in the Shulchan Aruch that you are qualified to make decisions about. So it just, it'll say on it, you know, from this page to that page. It's very qualified compared with the way it was at one time. And it was assumed that rabbis knew all these things.
One question on the fowls. I don't recall seeing chickens mentioned anywhere in the sacrificial...
No, you have doves.
Were there chickens in the ancient Israel?
Were there chickens?
Yeah, or eggs. Chickens in
the bush. I assume that there were. No, I assume that there were because if there weren't... The reason I assume that there was is that all of the laws of fowl are negative laws. Keep that in mind. The things, it doesn't say what fowl you can eat. The Torah says what fowl you can't eat. Okay? The way we know what fowl we can eat, because we don't know the definitions of the terms. When it says you can't eat this, you can't eat that, we really don't know what that means. We don't have any way to know what it means except one thing, and that is tradition. Tradition is the only way we can determine what fowl is permissible and what fowl is forbidden. So it's important for the community that chicken, there is a continuous tradition that chicken is a permissible fowl, and it's not one of those things forbidden. Yes.
Yeah, we started the discussion about sometimes you can have one rabbi deciding cases, but in the Mishnah you have different numbers of rabbis deciding different cases, but I don't think there's any instance at all in the Mishnah about a single rabbi deciding a case. So how do you connect what we're talking about here with the Mishnah?
Well, all I can say is that it's a different point of view.
But, I mean, it seems like it finds absolutely no support in the Mishnah.
No, because you could say, well, when the Mishnah was said what it said, it wasn't talking about a special case. All right? The Mishnah is not the totality of the law. The Mishnah is a selection of the law. And the assumption would always be, if the rabbis assume that there is another case, that simply it wasn't in the Mishnah. Now, it could be, and we've seen this from time to time, that that will be disputed. And they will have to find a baraita. And by finding a baraita, the strength of that is that you have something contemporaneous with the Mishnah to give it authority. Here we haven't seen that. We haven't seen any of this established by virtue of the baraitas. So my assumption is, that, to go back to where I started earlier, is that even what we have in the Mishnah is not assumed by the rabbis of the Mishnah to be the law of the Torah. Right? In fact, what we are seeing is practice. We're seeing practice, and maybe it was dominant practice, but we're certainly not seeing the only practice. And that there seem to have been other practices. 3, 5, and now we get to 1. And we see that 3 and 5... we saw the argument there. But one is qualified. That's a highly qualified, but qualified in two ways. It's got a lot of caveats connected with it. Person has to have a lot of knowledge, know how to apply the knowledge, and have judicial authority. So that apparently was another tradition. Let's keep going. Okay, we're now on 5A3. Ki hava nachid rav lebavel. Here's another case. Rav was a rabbi in the land of Israel. He spent also time in Babel, so he was one of these who lived in two places. Ki hava nachid rav lebavel. When Rav went down to Babylonia, and this is the generation after Rabbi Judah the Prince. Amar lei Rabbi Chia le Rabbi le Rabbi. Rabbi Chia said to Rebbe, right, these are all contemporaries, but Rav is a younger contemporary. Rabbi Chia and Rebbe are contemporaries. They're actual contemporaries. Ben Achoti Yored le Bavel. My sister's son is going down to Babylonia. All right? Yored? He asked the question. Can he render decisions? Yore. Yadin? What do you think the answer is? Yadin. Yadir vak yatir b'chorot. Can he free b'chorot? Listen to Rebbe's answer. Al yatir. He can't. He can't. So now the question is why? Right, we saw one case just now where somebody was given by Rebbe the right to be matir b'chorot, to say that this animal has a blemish that frees him from the law of the kohuna, of the b'chor. So then says, Maishna lamar deka kare denachi. Now, first the Gemara asks another question. Why is it that Rabbi Chia refers to one master, namely Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, as my brother's son? Umayishna lamar dekakare ben achoti. And why does he refer to the other master, Rav, as my sister's son? Right. Now, you might have said, it's obvious, and that's what the Gemara says next, v'chi tema hachi hava masa. You might have understood that it just means that one was of the brother and one was of the sister. Right. That that's just how it was. The ha mamar, but we know that the master said, Aivu v'chama v'shela umarta v'rabbi Chia kulhu b'nei abba bar acha karsama mikafri havu. That Aivu, the father of Rav, Chana, the father of Rabba bar Chana, Shaila, Marsa, and Rabbi Chia were all children of abba bar acha karsala from Kafri. Read the next. It is thus clear that Rabba and Rav were both sons of Rabbi Chia's brothers. Take it on. You can go back and contemplate that. But if you follow it carefully, that's what it means. So then, why did Rabbi Chia refer to Rav as the son of his sister? Okay? So they were both sons of the of brothers, but he refers to one as the son of the sister. Rav bar Achua dahava bar Achte. Rav was the son of Rabbi Chia's brother as well as the son of his sister. It was second marriage, and this was somebody who came in. They were not blood relatives. They were simply, it was a sister, his mother, the second mother, it was a stepbrother, a stepsister. Exactly. Rabba bar Chana bar Achui de Lav bar Achte. Rabba bar Chana was the son of Rabbi Chia's brother, but not the son of his sister. That's the first one we mentioned before. Rabbi Chia therefore called him the son of his brother. Okay, for what it's worth. The Ibayatema, but then another Gemara, that was sort of what do you call it in English? Oh, it's definitely a digression. That's for sure. But what do you call when you give somebody's yichas, yeah, there's an English term for it.
Genealogy.
Genealogy, right. Yeah, this was the genealogy. This is the genealogy. That's one way to react to why he had a different way of talking about the two. But the next way is actually nicer. The Ibayat Ema, if you want, I can say, Al Shem Chochmato, that he referred to him in relation to the sister because of his wisdom. Dichtiv, as it is written in the scriptures, Emor la Chochma Achoti At, it's in the book of Proverbs, say to wisdom, you are my sister. Okay? So in other words, when he referred to her as a sister, that was to refer to Rav's wisdom. That was,
but he didn't allow him to do the last one, the one of the son of the sister, right?
Say that again. But well, we'll get to that. Okay, here we go.
So why?
That's the next thing in the Gemara. Okay? Okay. So the Gemara then says, by the way, I want you to know that we've just read a whole Amud. I don't know when the last time was that we read an entire Amud in one evening, and we haven't stopped yet. Okay?
Must be slipping.
All right, we're moving. We're moving. Okay, we're flying. Flying. Okay, so Gemara says, Yatir Bechorot, right? Neirav permit Bechorot al Yatir. So that's repeating what we just read. Rebbe says he may not permit the Bechor. My Tama. What's the reason for that? Okay, that's Bobby's question. What's the reason? Right? Because the other one was permitted, the other one was not. Ilem mishum de lachakim. You might think that the reason is that he didn't know the law, that he wasn't wise. Haka amrinan de hakim tuba. We know that he was very wise. So you can't say about Rav that he didn't know the law. That's impossible to imagine. Impossible to imagine, right? Elamishum de la bakir bamume. And if you say, rather, he may have been very wise, but he wasn't an expert in the laws of mumin, blemishes in animals. Baha Mar Rav, don't you remember the Rav said, Shmona Asar Chodeshim Gadalti Etzel Ro'e Behema. For 18 months I grew up among herdsmen. This guy lived on the farm. He was such an expert. He had at such no 18 months. He was there living on the farm in order to learn this, the expertise here. Ella, so couldn't it be either of those reasons? So the Gemara then says, Ella lachalok lo kavod la Rabba Barchana. In order to pay respect to Rabba Barchana. In other words, you have just one. If Rebbe is going to say everybody is able to do this, then it draws away from the significance of this one person. Okay, I actually think there's another reason why it was, and that was because Rav was so great that he didn't want Rav to go to Babylonia. Right? He wanted it to be some liability because Rav was his major student, and in fact, Rav goes to Babylonia. I think that was probably a subtle way of Rebbe saying to him, don't go. Right? I let one guy go, and I don't want the other guy to go. That's my own theory. Okay? Yes?
Is there some significance here to the fact that the request for authorization is coming by one rabbi on behalf of another to Rebbe as opposed to Rav or Rabbi?
I don't know the answer to that. It could be. It could
it's
be.
Not part of
No, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not. In fact, in these cases, it's a child, which is kind of interesting that it's a father asking for a son. Yore, yore, yadin, yadin. So it's as if the son, doesn't have the status to ask, and only a contemporary has the status to ask about his son, to get permission for his son to be able to adjudicate.
Is there any indication that any of the experts on the blemishes could be bribed or anything? I mean, it really was a lot of their livelihood in terms of this extra cattle and things that they could eat or sell, whatever, it, you know, that was riding on the decision of whether or not...
Well, I don't think so, but it'd make a good short story. It'd be kind of an interesting story.
You know, it's got a lot of economic consequences.
Yeah, it does. It could extension.
Well, you can imagine the farmer wants the use of all of his cattle. And he wants the use of all of his sheep. So, yes, you're right. But
it never came up that any of them
no,
was
I don't
dishonest
think
about
it. not that I know.
Good.
Okay. But generally speaking, I think you can say that about judges in general. Right? In most cases, certainly in monetary cases, and in anything that has monetary impact, that it could be that one litigant would want to pay off the judge because it might be to his advantage to do that. So, you know, for that, the Torah says that your judges are not allowed to receive bribes. The Torah itself says that, and a judge has to be clean as a whistle.
But those are like individual cases. This is an ongoing... I mean, there must be hundreds and hundreds of these situations.
It was business. It was big business. I think there's no doubt about it. Okay.
I'm just impressed with the impact of the diaspora and now the breakdown of central authority and the rise of geography as a major determinant of Jewish practice. And obviously we're exactly in that same situation today, but I think that the profound disruption that diaspora produces and the uncertainty and the potential for fragmentation because of the geography, I don't think there's an answer to it, but I think the fact that unlike other religions that have single authorities that are recognized as by all, it obviously leads to a lot of downstream consequences.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's interesting. I just add to it that in those days, I realized that the land of Israel was subject to Roman authority. And Babylonia seemed to be such that there was a fairly contiguous Jewish population with a fair amount of authority where it was living. So one of the theories here is that there was, in a way, more stability in Babylonia than there was in the land of Israel in that period, and in most subsequent periods, frankly, until 1948. The current reality is a very, very recent reality. If you look at... Well, I remember then, these things that were formulated when I was a student in 1965. I was a student in Jerusalem. And then one of the major Jewish publications, which really has disappeared, was Judaism Magazine. Judaism Magazine, I'm sure many of you know Judaism. It was a significant journal. It was a journal. It was published by the American Jewish Congress. The Congress has disappeared, and its journal has disappeared. The journal essentially disappeared just before the Congress did. But in 1965, I remember I was sitting reading an article that was by Mordecai Kaplan. By Mordecai Kaplan on the failure of Israel to produce any intellectual leadership. That Israel was a total failure, that it was producing no scholars, no rabbis, and that it was an example of the weakness of Zionism, because Zionism hadn't gone in the direction of what he was advocating, which was cultural Zionism, Achada'am Zionism. Instead, it was political Zionism as opposed to cultural Zionism. Therefore, the culture had dissipated. This is 1965. About 10 years later, Jacob Neusner wrote the same article. Neusner, who was then Professor Brown, was very dismissive of the Israelis. Well, nothing like that could ever be written today. Impossible to write anything like that today, because the entire intellectual world has shifted, the weight of it has shifted to Israel. There are leaders in the American Jewish community who disagree with that, including some of my own colleagues. But I have been one of those who has said that one of the mistakes of American Jewish institutions is that they have to recognize that the strength of Jewish intellectual life has moved to Israel, and that in order for the American Jewish community to maintain its strength, it has to import Israelis. It has to import Israeli scholars to America. A lot of people disagree with me very strongly on that point, but that's how I feel. So it's just fascinating to see the progress of these things, that it so changes in a relatively short period of time.
It seems like the law of return plays a central role in framing the debate.
Maybe.
And it's all the money that went to Israel, and particularly Jerusalem, after the Six-Day War. And, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars to build yeshivas.
That's partly that. I'm thinking also in the intellectual world, in the world of the universities, for example. When I was in the seminary, it was important for Israeli scholars. We always had Israeli scholars who were imported. After a while, that went out of style. The reason was the Israeli scholars were Orthodox. I was trained by Orthodox scholars. They're all Orthodox. No such thing as a non-Orthodox Talmudist in my time. To be teaching in the seminary, nothing to do with your orthodoxy. It had to do with your willingness to add a layer of history and textual study to what you were doing, which is to say what the Haredim were not willing to accept. And at that time, YU was pussyfooting with it. They were working with it. And there was a time in the 50s when there was an effort to reconcile the seminary and YU. That didn't last very long, but such an effort actually took place in the 50s. But we had scholars. I'm the product of people who today would never be in the Jewish Theological Seminary.
In
the Jewish Theological Seminary. They would not be there anymore. The seminary wouldn't allow them in, and they wouldn't go. Both those things would happen. It's a new generation, but let's say the counterparts of those people. It's on both sides. There was a long time that the seminary just didn't want to deal with those people. It wanted to create its own homegrown American, and not only American, but out of the conservative movement. Because we were a conservative movement, and we could do it on our own. I was always opposed to that. I think it's...
Why do you think they weren't able to do that? Why was the JTS unable to do it?
Well, they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to... why couldn't they create their own? Because the reality is that to function in Jewish studies, it's very unlikely that you can reach a high level of scholarship without a tremendous amount of childhood learning. And that really is still the province of the yeshiva world. An effort was made and is being made right now, and we'll see how effective it is. We will only see down the road to see whether the non-Orthodox yeshivot will be able to produce that level of scholarship. But when you're talking about the classical scholars that I was trained by, these were all products of the European yeshivas. These were all European yeshiva products. And that transferred itself to Israel. To the extent that there was any transfer, that transferred itself to Israel.
Is why you've been able to produce these kinds of American scholars?
A little better than the seminary has. A little better. I think that they've been more effective because they early on decided that they would not invest themselves in synagogues, but they would invest themselves in day schools. YU early on made that decision that the day school movement was the most important investment that it would make. I must say that probably time will show that they were correct as far as producing a certain level of scholarship. It has produced a certain level of scholarship, and what we are looking at today as the resurgence of Orthodoxy, you know why that's happened? For two reasons. It happened because really 50 years ago they said we are going to develop day schools, and that's where we're going to put our emphasis, number one. And number two, the birth rate. They remain able to maintain a relatively high birth rate. So given those two factors of a powerful school system and a higher birth rate, that I think has made the difference.
What kind of scholarship are you talking about? Are you talking about the JTS type of scholarship that involves like this historical?
Well, I'll give you an example, and with this we'll close. My teacher, Rabbi Edward Gershfield, Professor Edward Gershfield, was trained in yeshivas in Winnipeg, Canada. So he used to say it to us like this. He would say, boys, he always called boys. He would say, boys, I'm the last professor of Talmud. I'd say, Dr. Gershfield, what do you mean the last professor of Talmud? He said, the next generation coming out of this seminary, there'll be a professor of Baba Kama, and a professor of Sanhedrin, and a professor of Baba Metzia. There'll be professors of individual tractates, but no professors of Talmud. That was his point of view. I leave that to be seen. To be continued.
One thing about that play, I've never had a bad meal. It's very consistent.
It's also true. You're correct.
They could have had the seminary would have been successful. They were successful, but the university.
It worked quite a lot.